an interview for the Shoe Industry Oral History Project at the Museum LA. The date is April 30th, 2010. This is Andrea Lumgia, and this morning I'm interviewing Ralph Gould in Auburn, Maine. Ralph, could you just start by giving me your full name?
Ralph A. Gould, Jr.
And where and when were you born?
I was born in Haverhill, Massachusetts, in, you want to know the year? 1923, which obviously makes me fairly old, doesn't it?
And did you grow up in Haverhill or move to?
No, not very long. My dad was born in Haverhill as well, and we can get into the beginning of the company, which will explain why we left Haverhill. But I left Haverhill at the age of five, so I'm pretty nearly a maniac, not quite, but
right.
Pretty nearly.
And what were your parents' names?
My father was Ralph Gould, Sr. My mother was Thelma Swan Gould, or Thelma M. Gould. She didn't maintain her maiden name. She was from Athol, Mass., and they were married and came to Norway, Maine, amazingly, on their honeymoon.
Oh, was that their first time coming to Maine?
No, he traveled Maine, and we'll get into that as we move along.
Okay. So, you were in Haverhill till age five.
Indeed.
And then where did you go?
Came to Auburn. And do you want me to get into the beginnings of the business?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Your dad, what was his business?
Well, he was with a counter company in Dover, New Hampshire, called Spalding Counter Company. And they had another division called Three Line Counter Company. And he was a salesman for that company, covering Maine and New Hampshire. And he came to Maine and discovered that there was a small company just started in Lewiston, amazingly, in what I remember as the Morenci Block in Haverhill, which is in Lewiston, which is now where the Chamber of Commerce is in Lewiston. Are you familiar with that building?
No.
In Lower Lisbon Street?
Okay, yeah.
Near the school down
right.
there? Well, that was an industrial building at that time. They oftentimes now refer to as the Pontiac Garage, because later on it became Pontiac Center's location. But in 1928, my dad found out that this business was for sale, because the gentleman who started it, by the name of Price, had tragically been in an automobile accident, was killed, and so this little embryo business that I think only employed 16 people was on the market. He thought this was a wonderful opportunity to do something on his own, and he contacted Henry Scammon, who was then the superintendent of the Three Line Counter Company in Newburyport, Massachusetts. And the two of them decided they should buy this little operation up here in Lewiston, Maine. Well, that was not so easily done, because Mr. Scammon had five children at that point and didn't really have the resources to purchase the company. But his father was a Superior Court Justice in New Hampshire, and he decided he would provide the $5,000 necessary to buy Mr. Scammon's share of the business. And my dad was a singer, and semi-pro, and made money singing at weddings and funerals and in church and this sort of stuff. And he had amassed sufficient funds to provide his $5,000. So putting them together with the help of a bank in Lewiston, they bought the company, which was then called Twin City Counter Company. But when they bought it, it became Gould and Scammon.
And so tell me what a counter is.
I'm glad you asked that, because but we should have gotten perhaps into that at the beginning. A counter is the stiffening in the back part of the shoe that supports the heel. And it's located, it's a molded, it was at this time, we're talking about, a molded product that was inserted between the outer material of the shoe and the lining of the shoe, cemented in there with either latex or paste, and and then assemble onto a last, a shoe last, and then process through the manufacturing procedures. Now, originally, a counter, and that's an interesting name, because originally, it was, in England, it was called a stiffener. And then in France, it was called a contrefort, C-O-N-T-R-A-F-O-R-T, contrefort. And then when we did our business in Canada, we discovered they would call it renfort. Now, contrefort means stiffener in French, and renfort means reinforcement in French. I suspect what happened is when the shoe industry came to America, they anglicized contrefort in the counter.
Uh-huh.
And I presume, although I've never been told that's the story, but that's my presumption of the development of the name, because the name doesn't reflect what's happening, does it? Well, where are we now?
So your dad and Mr. Scammon bought the Twin City
Counter company, yeah.
And now, did they change the name immediately?
Yes. Oh, yeah. When they established the corporation, mm-hmm. it then became Gould & Scammon Inc. Incorporated, and they continued in that. I'm trying to think whether we said everything we needed to say. No, we didn't say. Before I get into that,
sure.
We should talk a little bit about how counters started. Because they weren't in the form that we manufactured. Originally, they were leather. They were leather blanks that they cut out of a piece of sole leather. And they would thin around the edges of the thing called skiving. They would take, with a knife, they would take the edge, they would thin the edges of the blank. Then they would wet the leather blank and put it in the shoe and let it dry in the shape that they had developed over the crude last that they were then using. Well, that became incorporated into the molding process. They developed molding machines so that they could shape the leather into the form that matched the last that they were going to make the shoe over. And that they proceeded with that for a long, long time. Then they decided they could use fiberboard and save a lot of money. So they then went through the same process as they did with leather with fiberboard. And fiberboard was manufactured in lots of places, but we had a plant right here in Hackett's Mills, which is on the way to Mechanic Falls, and there was another plant down in Bar Mills manufactured by a company called Rogers Fiber, and they were our main source for fiberboard. So anyway, we went from flat leather to molded leather to fiberboard, and then we even became more sophisticated later on with leather boards and plastic components within the material. So that's kind of the story on the material that was used. Mm-hmm. Now, trying to catch up where we were, we were talking about.
So you're on Outer Lisbon Street.
Yeah, we were out on Outer Lisbon Street from 1928 to 1933. And in 1933, that was the year of the New Auburn Fire, which was a disastrous event that burned down loads and loads of properties in New Auburn. And where we were at the Lower Lisbon Street, we could look right over at the New Auburn Fire, and in 33, I was 10 years old, and I remember my dad took me to the factory to look at the fire. It scared the daylights out of me to see that terrible, terrible conflagration. Well, they were then in the process of moving to Auburn, and they was afraid the fire was going to jump the river and hit Lower Lisbon Street, so they had moved all the machinery. They loosened up all the machinery so if they had to, they could move it out and get about the move. But several days subsequent to the fire, they did move to Court Street in Auburn in the basement of the Charles Cushman shoe factory. 207 Court Street was the address. And we stayed there until we built our own building in 1964 out on Minot Avenue, which is a long way into the story,
right,
if we will.
Right. So talk about the company and how it grew and what your role was as you got older.
Okay. Amazingly, the company was started in 1928, and you can't think of a worse time to start a company, 1 year before the market crash. Well, the good news, I guess, was that both my dad and Mr. Scammon had all their resources sunk in the business, so they didn't lose any money in the market because they didn't have any invested in the market. It was a terrible time, but they just kept plugging along with the customers that they had, and slowly grew. And then along, of course, then you had the New Deal in 32, and the NRA, which was the Roosevelt's program. And then in 1937, they had a disastrous shoe strike in Auburn and Lewiston. The CIO wanted to organize the shoe workers here. And it was a terrible time. 8 factories closed up as a consequence of the strike, and all of the factories were hurt badly by the attempt to organize. The CIO was not successful, and that's a story within itself. But a local union took place. We were never unionized, our company, but it did. Raised Ned with the sales of the company, because all their customers were hurt by this devastating strike. Well, they recovered from that, and then along came World War II, and production of shoes was extremely limited. Leather wasn't available. Everything went into the war effort. Much of the product that we were then making became military. So that they struggled through that. In the meantime, I was getting educated and graduated from high school. I went to Hebron for a year, and then I went to the University of Maine for a year and a half, and then I went into the service. My associate, who joined the company in 1947, Henry Scammon's son, Oscar, was with the engineers in Europe. I was an aviation cadet and became a pilot with the 9th Air Force and did my thing. And came back to the university and finished up in 1948 and joined the company then, joined Oscar Scammon. And so there was Henry Scammon, Ralph Gould, Ralph Gould Jr., and Oscar Scammon running the company. Everything improved after the war.
It did.
Business was generally throughout the country was good. Everybody was recovering from a disastrous period, and so we did very, very well, and the company grew. We expanded during the pre-war years. The company was pretty much producing product for shoe factories in the New England states, which means Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts. They did a little business in New York, in the New York area, but that's where most of it was. Well, we decided we better go elsewhere and do better. And so we opened up upstate New York. We did Pennsylvania. We employed a fellow by the name of Al Boucher to be representing us in New Hampshire and Massachusetts. And I covered Maine and upstate New York, and then forayed into Canada. And we did some business up there. In fact, a substantial amount of business in the locations that I've cited. So my dad was not doing too well physically in the 50s. He had emphysema, which amazingly, well, because he smoked, and that was one reason he had emphysema, and it didn't help his singing too much. But he became less and less able to carry on. And so in 1956, I became much more responsible for what he was doing, and he died in 58. But before he died, he and Henry Scammon decided that it was time to let Oscar Scammon and I have our leash, if you will. So we organized a new company, continuing to call it Golden Scammon, and we bought out over time the old Golden Scammon from my dad and Henry Scammon. Henry Scammon stayed on as a consultant, and more than a consultant, really, but Oscar and I owned the business then. And all of the vagaries that go with that. Can we?
Well, to me, it's amazing that your father and
Henry Scammon,
Henry Scammon built this business from 1928 and just continued on for years and years, and then you and Henry's son Oscar took it over and continued it. I mean, it's a unique situation where two people from two generations from two families can get along so well. How did you make it work all those years?
Well, I can answer that easily. I think when the business started in 28, Henry Scammon was then very, very familiar with counter operations. He became Mr. Inside. My dad was Mr. Outside because his expertise was in sales. And so the two of them allowed their area of expertise to rule decisions if there was ever a debate. And so they just never got in each other's hair. They got along just wonderfully well, amazingly well. Oscar Scammon was sort of like his dad. He was not comfortable in the area of sales, and I was. So we sort of duplicated the original intent of our dads. Although I must say that I probably got more aggressive about things in general. I was the president, and by decision, he became the treasurer, and I was the president. And so I tended to maybe muck in a little bit more than. But we got along fine. He was very willing to let me have a say in a lot of areas that perhaps. Well, we became more sophisticated, and we
right.
needed to have a voice. We had a director, Link Adam, the only outsider in the firm, and he was ran an accounting firm, so he helped us a great deal in the fiscal area of the business. We were blessed with some terrific employees. People that stayed, some that were started in my dad's days in the 30s, stayed right with us. Two of them were our foremen. And we just had wonderful, wonderful people working for us. When we were 25 years old, it was amazing how many of the people that were then employed by us had been with us for long, long periods of time. And contrary to the philosophy of a lot of companies, we encouraged relationships with our employees from the point of view of bringing in their cousins and their kids and their friends. And the only time it was bad is when somebody died. We had a lot of people had to go to the funeral. But we had wonderful interrelationships with our employees. Another thing that we did that is a real bragging point, in the very early 50s, we established a profit-sharing plan, and it was one of the early profit-sharing plans in the state of Maine. In fact, when my dad died, the distribution from the plan became a court evaluation to determine the tax factors in the distribution. And for many, many, many years, we gave the maximum which was allowed to give to profit sharing, which is 15% of your earnings. And we just felt great about things like that. So, and I think this is one reason why we had such loyalty amongst our people. The plan was not one that you could just carelessly decide you wanted in or out of. You really, if you, we took the position that it was a retirement plan. And if you decided you wanted it so bad that you were willing to give up your job, you could get it. But most people left it set. And as a matter of fact, we had when our two oldest employees from 1931 retired, it was the best thing that could happen to them because they had this lovely nest egg which added to the Social Security, made it possible for them to have a very comfortable retirement. So we felt great about that. Now, what else do you want to know?
In terms of numbers of employees, do you recall how that went up and
yes.
down? Because
yeah, the biggest year of the company was in 1968. That was the highest sales level. Mm-hmm. And we had 140 employees. And when you figure that the Twin City Counter started out with 16, that was a lot of gain.
And you're now over on Minot Avenue?
The company is still on Minot Avenue, but they're not doing much in the product that we created because the shoe industry has changed mm-hmm. dramatically from those days. We were very concerned about diversification. You could tell in 1968 that the shoe industry was destined for decline, and it happened very gradually after that peak point. And so we knew that if we didn't get into some other things, it might be a little difficult for us. So starting in the late 50s, we started looking for opportunities to diversify. And one of the things that we did that was not too smart on our part, we bought a fledgling bottling company. Knee-High Beverages was not doing well, and so we said, well, that's an interesting approach. So we bought it and tried to make fortunately the company owned it, not us individually. And we had all of the lost leaders in the industry. We had Royal Crown and Diet Right and Orange Crush and Highest Root Beer and Moxie. We had Moxie. And we thought, probably if we had enough brands, even though they weren't the leaders, we could do all right. The amazing thing was that Royal Crown was on the edge of terrific success because they had Diet Right, which was the first diet beverage.
Oh, before Tab?
Before all of those. And they were doing well, but it was made with cyclamates. And cyclamates was declared a no-no by the federal government, and it was you couldn't use it anymore. Well, of course, what happened is they found some other things that they could use, but they had the edge of the diet business. The federal government said, you can't do it, and then they came along about 4 years later and said, oh, we made a mistake. It's okay now. But Royal Crown lost the opportunity to be the leaders, and we lost an opportunity too. Well, we struggled with that for 4 years. We added beer in and wine, and we never made it, so we gave it up. But I should add at this point that we felt we needed some additional leadership in our company. And so I had a friend of mine that I went to high school with, a local boy by the name of Dana Bunker. And Dana was with United Shoe, and in the,
and we were talking with Dana Bunker. Dana Bunker, yeah. He joined you in 59.
In 59. And he had an engineering background, and that seemed to be where we needed some strengths. And we knew that sooner or later, molded counters, as they were being produced at that point, had to have some added sophistication, because the shoe industry was looking then at what they call backpot molding. They wanted to be able to put a product in the back of shoes that could be formed in the shoe manufacturing process rather than preformed as we were presently doing things. So we hired A.D. Little to give us an assist in the area of developing a thermoplastic product. And Dana became responsible for that segment of our business. We were not successful, regretfully. So we attacked some other areas, and one of them was the ill-fated bottling business, which Dana ran too. He was the guy that we sent off on errands to try to do better. We also bought a heel business and ran that for a while, then sold it. That was a good exercise in not making any money, but learning another aspect of the business. And I'm jumping around a little bit, but in 69, I had mentioned earlier that we were doing business in Canada, and I can take a little credit, I guess, for this. Our product was extremely well received in Canada, but our prices were higher. The American dollar was higher than the Canadian dollar. But despite that, the women's manufacturers in Canada, really in eastern Canada, and mostly in Montreal, a little in Quebec, some over in Ontario, really liked the quality of our product. So we were doing pretty well and hurting the local boys up there. We decided that maybe it was a good time to do business, to have an operation up there. So a fellow by the name of Fred Oberlander, who was a friend of ours, ran a small counter operation, and he decided that it would be great to merge our talent with his in his plant and with some of his equipment and some of ours. So we set up a company called GSM, Gould, Scammon, Milmont being Freddie's company. And we just did wonderfully well up there. Boy, they were delighted. The Canadian manufacturers were delighted to have us, because it improved their product at the same time.
And so that way you had a local, the supply was local. It wasn't a lot of
And then you, thus you avoided the conflict between the Canadian dollar and the U.S. dollar. So Dana and Oscar sometimes and I will be going back and forth to Canada quite frequently for over a two-year period. Then one of the competitors in Canada, being more than painfully aware of our presence up there, offered to buy the business and offered to give Fred a chance to be the sales manager of the company that would result from the purchase. It was too good to be passed up. From Freddie's point of view, he had a building up there and machinery and so forth. Mm-hmm. So we sold, and we sold advantageously. So, and we had to accept a 5-year agreement to not compete in Canada. So for 5 years, we had to stay out. After the 5 years, we went back up again and continued to do pretty well in Canada. But I'm getting well ahead of myself. But that was there was an adage that you heard often. It was shoemaker, stick to your last, meaning stick to the things that you know how to do well. Mm-hmm. And so we were guided by that. We probably looked at least a dozen opportunities, some within the shoe industry, some outside the shoe industry that, that might represent opportunities to diversify. None of them really suited our talents or provided what we presumed to be a good opportunity. We did, however, decide to get into the box toe business, which was somewhat akin to counters, being the front end of the shoe and the back end of the shoe, both something that had to be inserted into the shoe. And so we bought a company called Regano Box Toe in Haverhill and ran that for, I was speaking about Regano Box Toe, and it was in 1976 that we bought this company in Haverhill, back in Haverhill, and ran it for a number of years using box toe material produced by Foss Manufacturing. Ultimately, they wanted to vertically diversify and pressed us to sell Regano to them, which we did, again, profitably to ourselves. That was in 76.
At that point in time, were you finding your suppliers, number of suppliers shrinking? Were you having to go further and further to get the same amount of business?
You don't mean suppliers, you mean customers.
I mean customers, yes. Sorry.
Yes, and I'm glad you introduced that subject. We had, at that point, Dick Varney as the full-time salesman in Maine. We had Bill Magg, a full-time salesman in New Hampshire and Massachusetts. We had a full-time salesman in Pennsylvania who covered upstate New York. We had representatives in New York City and the environs of New York City, down into Baltimore, Maryland. We had representatives in every other shoe area in the United States and Canada, except St. Louis. And no, sorry, we had someone in St. Louis, except California. Tried to do business in California, but they didn't use counters sufficiently to make it worthwhile. I think in 1968, we were the largest manufacturer of shoe counters, perhaps in the world, certainly in North America. So, yeah, we grew. We grew a lot. And I think it's a credit to the darn good product that we produced. We had all of the big names except General and International, who were pretty much in St. Louis and in that south central part of the country. We did something with them, but not much. We had acquired all of Entica Johnson's business, most of Melville's business. We did business with practically all of the big names. And so it was a pretty satisfying bit of business. And of course, I used to have to travel all over North America to see the customers. I wanted to see everybody twice a year. So we had a very close relationship with them, not only making a good product, but with close contacts between the factory and them. So that worked out well. My son came on board in 1977. We decided that we needed another executive in the company to handle the growth. And he had just graduated from the University of Maine and amazingly had decided to ride his bicycle with two of his classmates from the East Coast to the West Coast. He put his bicycle wheels in the water in Olathe Beach and put his bicycle wheels in the water out in Seattle, or near Seattle, Washington, or Oregon, one of those places. And he stayed out there because his lady friend, whom he married, Anne, was going to school out in Victoria, British Columbia. Well, when we decided we needed somebody, I contacted him and I said, here's a chance for you if you want to take it. He took it. Came home and went to work for us. in all aspects of the business. He understudied Oscar Scammon and understudied me, and was a terrific addition to the company.
As he was growing up, as he was a kid growing up, did he sort of get immersed in the business then, or was it really after when he was grown up that he...
Yeah, the latter.
Yeah.
Contrary to Oscar Scammon and I, when we were kids, we would go to the Y on Saturday and come back, and the plant ran Saturday mornings oftentimes, or at least the management was run. We'd go in and punch the time clock and pretend we were workers. So Oscar and I were much closer to the company during our growing years than my son was. He was pretty much aware of it, but he didn't get wrapped up in it like that. But once he got involved, he was totally involved. Did a lot of work in Canada. And then when we sold the business in 83, which is, I'm advancing a little bit here, he became president of the successor company at the request of the people that bought it. And I became chairman, so vice chairman, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. And so they recognized his talent at that point, and he stayed on as president of the successor company for 7 years before he went on to do other things.
And what was the successor company?
Okay, you're ready to get into that. We received an inquiry, a blind inquiry in 1982 of somebody that wanted to buy us. And I wasn't very much impressed. We felt that the company had its difficulties as the shoe industry was declining, but I wasn't much impressed with somebody who didn't want to identify themselves as the who was interested. Well, they got back to us a little later on. It turned out to be a company called L. Farber in Worcester, Massachusetts. Now, L. Farber was a manufacturer of leather welting, and they were the premier manufacturer of leather welting, which impressed me. And they said they wanted to buy the premier company in commerce. And so, well, all of a sudden, our ears perked up a little bit. Oscar Scammon, I think, was enthusiastic about it because he did not have a son in the business and didn't plan to at that point. I was a little nervous about pulling the rug out from underneath David, my son. But we talked about it, and he said, "Dad, this is the best thing we could do. We can see the handwriting on the wall that things are going to get tougher, and this is a wonderful chance to become liquid." So having that knowledge, we agreed to sell. But I'm a little bit ahead of myself here.
Okay, well, go back to where we need to be.
And I'm trying to think where that is, huh? Hold on a second. Yeah. I had mentioned earlier that we had investigated a lot of purchasing opportunities and declined most of them. We did buy Regana Box, though. We also bought three counter companies, one in Rochester, New York, and one in, initially, the first one was Rogers Fiber. Rogers Fiber was a supplier of our fiber board. They also had a counter plant, and it seemed to them that they were a little bit in conflict of interest, manufacturing something that was in competition with the people he sold board to. So they wanted to sell. Well, that was our first purchase of a counter plant. We bought Rogers in 1964. And I'm glad I mentioned 1964 because that was the year that we decided we had to get more space. If Rogers wanted to become part of our operation, we had to have space. And so we started looking around. We had about 25,000 square feet in the basement of the Cushman building, which had served us well. So we started looking around, and we found out there was space. Bob Roy had some space over at the Continental Mill, and that looked pretty good to us. It was a lease arrangement. So we said, I guess maybe we ought to take that space. It was going to be adequate for our needs. So I went over to Woody Brackett, who was then city manager of Auburn. And I said, Woody, I hate to tell you this, but we're going to have to leave Auburn. We're going over to Lewiston. He says, you wait just a minute, young fella. And he said, I think we can do something for you. Well, don't you know, in a matter of a few days, he had lined up some land that the Auburn Business Development Corporation owned out on Minot Avenue, said it would help us to get started, and we ended up building a brand new building of 48,000 square feet out on 1130 Minot Avenue, which was the best thing we could have done. So that happened in 64. We moved, Herbie Callahan built the building for us on a handshake, and he built it so that the 2 weeks of the vacation period in 4th of July vacation period, we could prepare to move in, and we had that 2 week window which wouldn't mess up our production. And we moved Rogers in, and we moved ourselves in, and we were operational, I think, 1 week after the vacation period. And it was wonderful. We put another addition on, another 10,000 feet addition onto the building before we got through. We also bought Prosper Chavanel, which was a counter company. And then in 82, New England Counter Company, which was our major competitor, located in the Lound building here in Auburn, decided they wanted to sell. They had merged six or seven counter companies into their counter company, and we had merged three into ours. So we ultimately bought New England Counter Company, which increased our productivity 25%, and we were the amalgamation of about nine different counter companies that had existed before all this took place. Which brings me to the point that when we got going in after the war, there were 30 counter companies in the United States that produced the same sort of product we did. And when we finally merged New England in, I think there were only five left. Everybody else had either sold or liquidated or whatever. So, no sooner had we sold, had we bought New England Counter, than this event with Al Farber came along. So, we looked all the more attractive, of course, to Farber. And so, we ultimately sold to them in 83. And the Oscar Scammer decided to retire. He didn't want to become involved in the new Gould and Scammer. But Dana and my son and I all joined up, and David, my son, became president. Dana stayed on in his various roles, and as did I. And I stayed with them until the end of 1990. Dana retired, I think, in 1987 to live in Florida, but he stayed close. And David stayed with the company until 91. But at that point, they were having difficulties because they had gotten too greedy and bought too many other companies and ultimately had to sell them off. And so in 1991, Norman Farrar of Canada Counter Company bought Gould & Scammon, owned by Al Farber, and changed the name to Enefco, E-N-E-F-C-O, which stood for Norman Farrar. And it continues to operate out on Minot Avenue, although Norman sold it to another group later on. They still produce some molded counters, not many, military largely, a few women's old-fashioned shoes, nun shoes, so to speak. Still being made with molded counters, and so is Red Wing out in Wisconsin, still uses molded counters from this company. that is probably a snapshot of everything, and I've left a ton of things out, but maybe that's close enough.
Yeah, that's an amazing story.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.